And today I'm going to do a fairly impossible task, which is to talk mostly about Eastern Europe in the interwar period. I sent around a rather lengthy list of terms, so I don't have to write on the board and you can't see it anyway. I'll work from that, so it'll help you, you know, understand. But the big points are clear, and the maps will help you as well. But just a couple things at the beginning that are perfectly obvious. That, you know, 1914, I mean, few people could have imagined that they would sweep away four empires, et cetera, and take the lives of millions of people. In 1918 and 1919, there was the Great Illusion. And the Great Illusion was held by Wilson and lots of other people, is that wars were started by evil people in high places, which may often be the case. that the problems left by the Treaty of Versailles were basically insoluble, and that the 1920s and 30s is basically a continuation of the war, and that you can look at the entire period, 14 to 45, as a 30 years war. And that Europe was in depression basically the entire time between the wars, and as we'll see when I talk about Eastern Europe and East Central Europe, that has a lot to do with the instability, the chronic instability of the period. Now, Western Europe and the United States were really not in depression between 24 and 29, and then the thunder comes in 29. And the United States doesn't get out of the Depression until basically World War II, instead of, the war economy helps them do that. But Eastern Europe and the places where the instability and the lack of parliamentary traditions was so important is in agricultural depression the entire time. And that by 1939, in Central and Eastern Europe, only one state, Czechoslovakia, remains a parliamentary regime. In all of the others, the Eastern Europe of little dictators and fascist parties and right-wing agrarian populist parties that didn't, some of them didn't start out right-wing, poisoned the political atmosphere. And the Treaty of Versailles, you know, when they meet and these delegations meet, including the former president of Yale, future president of Yale, then Charles Seymour, was in the American delegation there. They were convinced that they could put an end to all wars, and they would get Germany to sign on the dotted line, saying we started it all. And as I'll argue next week, and it's perfectly clear, that was a catastrophic mistake, because the war was, Germany arguably had a greater war role in starting the war than the other places. But this guaranteed the perpetual hostility of an ever-increasing number of right-wing parties, of which the most vicious and the most successful would be the Nazis, opposed the very existence of the Weimar Republic, and became what, as I'll explain in a minute, a revisionist state. A revisionist state is one that wanted to revise the Treaty of Versailles, because people of their ethnic, dominant ethnic group had ended up on the wrong side of the frontier. And if you'd fought a war that was based upon national claims in 1914, in which aggressive nationalism was one of the root causes of the war, the successor states that are created out of these collapsed empires find themselves facing the reality that you could get all the maps you wanted, and you could get all the cartographers that you wanted, and geographers, and bring them all to Versailles, and bring them all to the French suburbs, Trianon, and Sèvres, and Neuilly, and the others, Saint-Germain, that became named after the treaties with the individual powers, but you couldn't draw lines around national groups that were going to incorporate everybody within the country of their choice. You couldn't do it, and that leaves a permanent factor of for instability. And if you don't believe me, look at the Balkans in the 1990s, which were the worst atrocities since the death camps in World War II, and in which ethnic cleansing and rape as a means of waging war became a reality again, in which those old hatreds had never been extinguished. And so the great illusion was that there wouldn't be any more wars. And in the case of Germany, as we'll see, that the troops who were demobilized, who came back, they kept drilling in their basements, the Freikorps in Germany. And that lots of people, among them, just one of millions, the young Adolf Hitler, the argument, the view that they held was that the problem wasn't to have fought the war in the first place, which was a Wilsonian view of the war, but the problem was not to have won the war. And the problem is, how do you explain to home that you've lost a war when your troops are far, far inside Germany? And the other, I'm getting ahead of my story, but it's just such a complicated subject, all of this, it's a little hard not to. And the other problem was, if you're punishing losers in World War I, you're often punishing them in a way that seems to violate the very principle that you hope to espouse of, you know, each country, each people, more or less their own country. And the powers that become the revisionist powers, almost all were on the losing side. And they're the ones that by the very principles espoused at Versailles, that basically just simply get screwed. And as the Hungarians put it, no, no, never. That was their response. No, no, never. And these powers, of which the most dangerous ultimately is Germany, far more powerful in defeat than France is in victory, basically vow to get even. Not the Weimar Republic, but those people who wanted to destroy the Republic. And then Eastern Europe will be full of little Hitlers, little racists, dictators, who are also convinced that the next one will get it back. We'll get it all back, and we'll bring it back with a percentage of interest as well. And increasingly, a point that I better make in a while, that they begin to look at, in the Europe of extremes, as Germany is a very compelling model. And the Eastern European states that had certainly reasons to increasingly fear Germany, but begin to see Germany as a rather successful model. And the Europe of the extremes, as Eric Hobsbawm has called it, is basically, if you exclude the Soviet Union, and if you exclude, which is another kind of totalitarian state, and if you exclude the role of the communist parties as a destabilizing force in many of these countries, is a Europe of fascism. And they just keep right on marching, because fascism, part of fascism is they're better, fascists are better describing it how they will take power. Marching, violence, and whom they hate, than what they will construct afterward. But what they will construct afterward in all of these places will be a totalitarian fascist state that is based upon the principle of totally over-the-top aggressive nationalism and anti-whatever the minorities are, particularly the Jews. And anti-Semitism becomes an important part of all of this. So the map, the guys with the maps and the pencils and trying to draw the little squiggly lines, it doesn't really work out very well. And Wilson comes back in utter defeat. And the American Congress doesn't approve the Treaty of Versailles anyway. And America enters, as you know, a period of isolationism, at least until the next time around. So that was a rather lengthy introduction to what I was going to talk about. So let's try to be more specific now. So what are the big time revisionist states? First, let me just start out with one that didn't lose, but is one in which, as you'll see when you read the chapter, where fascism is first saluted, and then take power, and that is Italy. Now, Italy wins. They're open to offers, open to the highest bidder, and they join in 1915 because the Allies can promise them more. They promise them part of the Tyrol, you know, between Austria and Italy, and they promised them parts of much of the Dalmatian coast. And Italy went to war, well, for that reason, but also because in a country in which, you know, a sense of national unity basically didn't exist, there was a strong feeling that war will make Italians out of all these different people. You know, that's no real good reason to go to war, but they do go to war. And of course, they were being systematically denigrated by the other Allied leaders for woeful aspects of their army, which also took huge losses fighting the, you know, the Austria-Hungarian forces. And so when they come to Versailles, Orlando, who is their representative, he's the junior partner in this. They don't pay a lot of attention to him. And Wilson says, well, you can't give them the Tyrol because they don't have Italian majorities there, and they certainly don't have Italian majorities in the Dalmatian coast, which is populated by, logically enough, reasonably enough, by Croats. And so they don't get what they want. And Mussolini, who began his career as a socialist, he was the editor of Avanti, you know, Forward, which is the socialist paper. He becomes one of the originators of fascism, and he appeared, as you'll see in the book, on the cover of Time magazine 8 times. He's the guy that got the railroads to run on time in Italy, but only the ones to the ski resorts. Anyway, I don't have time to talk about him now, but so they're kind of a revisionist power. And then Mussolini's discourse about how he's going to turn the Mediterranean into an Italian lake, revive the Roman Empire, and all that has to be seen in that context. But Italy was not quote unquote a loser in World War I, but rather an aggrieved winner, and that, I guess, that's a good way of putting it. Now, the revisionist powers are those that lost. Revisionist powers, of course, no one was more of a revisionist than Germany, and the German Empire is destroyed. And Germany, I mean, again, this is hard to summarize all this, but Germany, from the very beginning, says that, well, if you're going to argue that national ethnic groups and where they live should determine the drawing of boundaries, then what the Allies did to Germany seemed extremely unfair, and not only to the far right in Germany. Now, this leaves aside the question that I'll come to next week. And John Maynard Keynes, who was a brilliant, brilliant guy, is the one who saw that this is recipe for disaster, the Treaty of Versailles. And he's the one, he said, this is just a truce. It's not the end of the war. Because if you make Germany pay for the whole war based on that they've signed the Wehrgeld Clause, you're going to so destabilize this country that eventually the right will take over. And that's exactly what happened. That's exactly what happened. But from the point of view of Germany, the most egregious loss that they suffered was the Polish corridor. If you go to Gdansk, which is a wonderful city, which was destroyed during the war, like most every city in Poland except for Krakow, which really got lucky. I can remember going to Warsaw, au temps des camarades, it was still, under the communist regime, and it was still, when I was a kid, there were still, you could see there where there once had been boulevards. The whole place was just absolutely razed. Krakow was very lucky because it survived. But what they do is Gdansk is rebuilt. But Gdansk was a German city. The Polish population was extremely small. You may know of Gdansk because that's where Solidarity began in 1979 and 1980. It's an important port there, and that's where Lech Walesa got his start in the whole Solidarity movement, including some of my friends who were young printers, historians who were young printers for Solidarity in those days. And as I've said a couple times, I go to Poland all the time for the last couple years, 5 times or something like that. But anyway, Gdansk, from the point of view of the Germans, was German. The vast majority of the population was German. The Polish corridor divided the rest of Germany from East Prussia. And it was resented. And because of by the Germans, because of there was a strong German population that remained. Of course, the Poles, when they look at Gdansk, they look back to when Gdansk was an important port then too in the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth. In fact, Poles are quite insistent. Polish historians had the whole concept of solidarity. I mean, of sovereignty that emerged. In the Netherlands and in England in early modern times was also being constructed in and around Gdansk. And the other big wound for the Germans was, of course, the Czechoslovakia, because the second largest ethnic group in the newly one of the successor states, along with Poland and Yugoslavia, the first, and I have the statistics and what I sent around to you, were Czechs, about 50%. Germans, if I remember correctly, were 23%. And Slovaks were 16%. And the other, of course, are other minorities. I mean, they're Ukraine and Poles and all sorts of things. And lots of the Germans were concentrated, the majority of Germans were concentrated in Prague, though there weren't as many of them as before. But I mean, above all, you know, I mean, in the whole area, the region of Bohemia, and in that region called the Sudetenland Germans. And when the Allies capitulate to Hitler's demands that part of Czechoslovakia, and then of course he munched the whole thing, pass into Germany. One of the reasons that they appease is they said, well, maybe he's got a point. You know, 1918, you know, we couldn't really put the people where they were supposed to be, and there are German majorities in good percentage of Bohemia. So maybe within the Czechoslovakia, maybe he's got a point. And that was an excuse, that was a rationale for appeasing him at a time that he might have been stopped, and which is in generals, his generals were just scared to death that there was going to be, that the Allies were going to fight then because they weren't ready for war. So Germany is above all the big revisionist power. More about this when we talk about Adolf Hitler next week. The other is of course, mess. The other the big one is, of course, I can't find it, but it doesn't matter. Is Hungary, and so Hungary loses. I got to remember these statistics. I might have put it wrong, but they lose. I think I remember them. They lose 25% of the Hungarian population to other states. They lose about between a half and two thirds. I should remember, but I don't. Of the land of the old Hungarian domains when they were in Austria-Hungary, when they were the, you know, supposedly after 1967, the equal partner of Austria. And so they lose the greatest percentage of that Hungarian population to Romania. And of course, the tensions between the Romanians and the Hungarians were extremely great. I mean, the linguistic differences are enormous because Hungarian is such a difficult language. It's just an isolated language. In that, I have a friend who retired here many years ago who speaks 18 from Eastern Russian, East European. Languages and literatures, who knows 18 languages. He knows like mostly every European language, Central European language. I said, do you know Hungarian? He says, no, it's too hard. And so that accentuates the sort of isolation from the Romanians. And again, in 1989, the great groundswell against Ceausescu and his horrendous wife, the dictators in Romania, began with Hungarian dissidents whose families had been generations since World War I stuck from their point of view in Romania. And so when you're trying to look at each of these countries and try to figure out why does some, you know, right-wing maggot, a right-wing dictator take power, is because as in the case of Adolf Hitler, if you say the same thing over and over and over again, pretty soon you get people to believe you. And Admiral Horthy, H-O-R-T-H-Y, who was an admiral in the Austrian-Hungarian Empire, he becomes an extraordinarily, you know, vicious dictator and an egregious collaborator during World War II, sort of an admiring junior partner of Hitler and the Nazis and the frenetic, aggressive Hungarian nationalism will. You can go to Budapest and go along the river, the Danube River in Budapest, and see where they've made a sad monument out of the shoes of Jews who were shot or just simply pushed into the swirling waters of the Danube by the Hungarian fascists in 1944. This is not dissing the Hungarians, you know, as a people. Obviously not. I have Hungarian friends, and I love Hungary. Budapest is my third favorite city. But the damage done by the revisionist claims in Hungary were simply amazing. And of all the after the Germans, and arguably even more than Germans, they had the most to be aggrieved about because losing so much of their country. Awarded as because they had lost to other places. Now the case of Austria also. I mean, Austria. If you go to Vienna, Austria. I mean, Vienna is such a wonderful, you know, huge musical place, full of broke. It's really it's a great city. And you think, oh, well, this is an enormous city for such a little country. And of course, what happens when the Austro-Hungarian Empire is dismembered? Austria becomes a small. And overwhelmingly German-speaking state. There are very few comparatively ethnic minorities living in what was became Austria after World War I. It's an imperial city. It's an imperial city, not reduced in size, but reduced in importance. So Hungary, huge reasons to be extraordinarily. Extraordinarily angry by the whole thing. Yugoslavia. I mean, they lose some land that they would have that they wish that they would have gotten. But again, Yugoslavia, you have this tremendous ethnic complexity. So in a way, that the successor state of Yugoslavia, maybe some of you have or will take Ivo Banac's courses, and he's a great Balkan. A historian, but the ethnic complexity, of course, is sort of a mini version of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, where Serbs, something like 40% of the population of Yugoslavia between the wars, and that would be really about the percentage until the whole thing collapses in the early 1990s, and with the Croats, the next largest percentage, and then followed by Slovenes, who were the wealthiest region and remained that until the end. The standard of living in Slovenia in the 1980s was about that of Italy, where if you went far down to Kosovo, where I've been, about which so much has been going on, and which now has been proclaimed independent, and it was absolutely impoverished. So the ethnic complexity is itself there too going to be a factor for a destabilization. And what about Poland? I mean, Poland is Poland had not been independent since 1795, since the Third Partition. And you had, as I've already discussed in another context, you've got Polish intellectuals, you've got political militants in the 1830s and again in the 1860s, who don't want to be part of Congress Russia, they don't want to be Congress Poland, they don't want to be part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, they don't want to be part of Prussia, they want and dream of an independent Poland. And so, what you have they get their independence in 1918 immediately. But the complexity, of course, is enormous to there, because you've already got these ethnic minorities who are there. I mean, the Germans are there. You've got huge numbers of Ukrainians. In fact, in eastern Poland, I mean, the cities like Zamość, where Rosa Luxemburg was born, which is a beautiful city, these are Polish cities. But the vast majority of the rural population are Ukrainian. They are Ukrainian. And this was a force of for quote unquote instability, and of course they will be killing each other off during World War II, and then the other minority, of course, are the Jews, and how many Jews were there in Poland in 1918, 1919? Well, Poland was considered to be before Israel. Poland was really the cultural heart of Judaism. There are 3 million Jews living in Poland. In the East, mostly Orthodox and Lubavitchers. When I was in, by the way, this is not just it's a side, but it's a telling aside. When I was in Zamość, we were taken to a synagogue which had been turned into a place where students, lycée students and middle school students exhibited their painting. And I asked the guide who was taking these sort of academics around and press editors and all this stuff. I said, "Well, look, how many Jews? What was the population of Zamość in 1939?" And he said, "The population of Zamość in 1939 was 39,000." He said, "How many Jews were living in Zamość who had been coming to the synagogue in 1939?" He said, 12,000. 12,000. I said, "How many Jews live in Zamość now?" Zero. Zero. The others, if they're lucky enough not to have been killed in the death camps. I just reviewed a book for the Globe about the ghetto in Łódź, LODZ. They were lucky to get out. I'm not to jump ahead, but the number of Jews who survived out of the 3 million was about 300,000 Polish Jews who I think came back to Poland at the same time. The point of this is that these ethnic tensions, particularly in a part of Europe where anti-Semitism had been just replete, how can you not? It's a 30 years war. How can you not leap ahead into World War II? Some of the massacres of Jews, for example, during this horrible period were done by Ukrainians in Ukraine, Lithuanians in Lithuania. And many of you have seen just horrific pictures. I can't remember if we have this awful picture that used to be in first edition. I don't even know if it's in the second edition. Who were beaten to death. Former colleague here, I don't really know, Jan Gross, wrote an important book called Neighbors about how Jews and Poles who lived in Poland in the 1920s and 1930s lived very peacefully in one village, and how almost without apparent instigation from the Nazis, who had been happy to kill them all and had planned to kill them all, just simply one day started killing them all and shot them all dead, beat them to death, put them in barns, burned the barns. And so these tensions, which is aggressive nationalism. In Poland, I go all the time. It's amazing. I mean, there still is this undercurrent of anti-Semitism, and I hope this is being filled. I sometimes forget. I mean, they may get letters from, but it's really incredible. I was being interviewed on Polish TV with this other guy, and it was a pleasure to denounce our president. But anyway, but I don't speak Polish. And another time we were all being interviewed, and they said, this guy said, he said, "What do you think of the Jew problem in Poland?" And I was about to kill him. I shouldn't say that, but take him out, and not really, but I was pretty mad. And then this woman who was there, who represents the Jewish community, such as it remains in Israel, she said, no, it's a question of language. But when we went to one of the Polish museums, which is the museum of the Warsaw Uprising, and they don't have a museum of the ghetto uprising. They have, we had to complain semi-officially about how they depicted Jews in the 1920s and 1930s. So this is not to dump on Polish. What is the dump on Polish anti-Semitism? But not as Poland as a state. But these tensions were they're exacerbated in World War, between the wars. Because if you've got these frenetic right-wing leaders who are aggressive nationalists in all of these places, and who are they denouncing? They're denouncing what? The Treaty of Versailles. Who? Romanians, if they are Hungarians, et cetera, you pick the nationality. And Jews most anywhere. And it was there. And so these folks are often, like Horthy, are preaching to the converted. They're preaching to the converted. And it's an obvious sad story. But in these revisionist powers, all this stuff is going on. I know less about, and don't have much time to talk about Bulgaria. But you have the same, which was lost, but you have the same kind of tensions. Turkey was just completely, that's arguably the harshest treaty. is that with Turkey, because they lose much of the most of what's left really in the Middle East of Turkey, and this gets transformed into mandates under British and French control. And of course, they lose as a losing power. They lose a land to their bitter arch enemy, Greece, and then this enormous exchange of populations begins, forced exchange of populations, as followed by, you know, voluntary between Turkey and Greece. But the case of Turkey is special because Ataturk, whom you can read about, you know, he becomes the sort of visionary president of a new Turkey, of a secularized Turkey, and does not go the way of for all occasional stridency, of the way of this sort of Europe of little dictators, the Eastern and Central Europe of little dictators. And even as I said, I mean, Czechoslovakia, where are we? I kind of left my lecture behind, but that's all right, because I'm doing the themes that we should be doing anyway, and you can read about the rest. Even in Czechoslovakia, you know, one can say, well, there was a democracy that really truly functioned. But there are enormous tensions in Czechoslovakia as well, because what you've got your Czechs, and your Czechs are the dominant population in Czechoslovakia, but they are basically Protestant, mostly Protestant. The Czech part, or what would become the Czech Republic, is, as you already know, largely Bohemia. Well, much of it is Bohemia. There's Moravia also, which is more poor, but it is very industrial. It is much more prosperous. And then Slovakia is almost entirely Catholic, and much more rural. It's basically a peasant society in which the Catholic Church, and particularly the very right-wing aspects of the Catholic Church, as opposed to the case of Poland, where the Catholic Church has basically been a force for progress, except for, you know, anti-Semitic currents in some parts of the clergy. And it's not surprising that in World War II, one of the, you know, the most horrendous collaborators and people cheering on, you know, the guards of the Jews, as they're packing them onto the train to be taken away and killed, was a priest. And again, I mean, I'm not dissing the Catholic Church. I was raised at a Jesuit high school, and again, but there were tensions within you know, Czechoslovakia also. That even in the triumphant case, I mean, triumphant until, you know, the German legions start marching in, and then they start killing Jews again there. Or they, not again, because there really hadn't been you know, pogrom and stuff like that there, was even there the it's the complexity of the whole thing that is simply, you know, it's simply amazing. But the big point, it's not big news, but the big point is that ethnic contentions, contested borders, the diplomatic problems caused by the or inherent in having these new states, Czechoslovakia, Poland, and Yugoslavia, will continue to be very, very important in a place that had virtually no parliamentary traditions. Where are the democratic traditions in even in a country like Poland, which had been, you know, divided up between these three empires? So it's pretty darn hard to suddenly say, well, now we are a republic, and try to make that work. It's very, very difficult. Indeed, you know, there's a mistake in that book, or at least my Polish friends tell me it's a mistake, as I have described Pilsudski, Pilsudski, who whose parents and who himself thought he was Lithuanian at the beginning, but I already talked about that. He's described as being right-wing. He began his career as being kind of left-wing. But he's the first to destroy a parliamentary regime, and he does that in 1926. Pilsudski is a great hero in Poland still. I was taken on almost a forced march to see his tomb. Why? Because he, in the miracle of the Vistula River — the Vistula is this monumentally important river in Poland — that the Red Army, Trotsky's Red Army, is moving toward Warsaw and imagining that they're going to move toward Berlin and assist this Russia, the revolution in Germany. And they're turned back in the suburbs of Warsaw, the miracle of the Vistula by Pilsudski. And of course, this gives him a kind of a prestige and identification with the Polish state that is obviously important. And so he, in 1926, he says, look, this is impossible. He puts an end to the parliamentary regime, at least in reality. And then, of course, it's in 1929 or 1930, he arrests the progressive opposition. So he behaves like these other dictators, except he's not putting people against the wall, or beating them to death and stuff, having them beaten to death by iron guards and all these groups. So that's one of the first to go. Now, compounding all of this is, to go back to what I said at the beginning, is that Eastern Europe, East Central Europe, incidentally, the Poles no longer want to see themselves as described as Eastern Europe. And then it was East Central Europe. And they say, you should go through your book and take out all references to Eastern Europe with regard to Poland. We are Central Europe. And that's how they see themselves. And again, it's impossible to overestimate the hatred and still the fear of Russia. And that's why they have this ridiculous idea of having American bases in Poland, which is just a crazy idea. But anyway, that's just my personal opinion in parentheses. But compounding all of this is that you've got a peasant society. All of these are peasant societies. The vast majority of the population are peasants. I think it's about 75% in Poland, and Poland, Warsaw is already very big, Krakow is very, very big. I keep talking about Poland because that's the one I know I know the best. But Hungary would be less because Budapest is such a large city, and also lots of the rural parts of Hungary had been amputated. But it's a peasant society. And what brings, and this is the argument of my good friend Tim Snyder, what brings peasants into politics in the 1920s is one thing, besides hating people not of the same ethnic group as them, depending on the place, and maybe being anti-Semitic because of their tradition of rural moneylenders and all this who happen to be Jewish and Jewish storekeepers in their perception, in the peasant perception of the world, is the hope of land reform, of maybe breaking up the big estates but at a minimum helping out poor rural people. And what happens is that in the 1920s and the 1930s is that poor rural people are being screwed, to put it a bit crudely, by what? By the agricultural depression. Because the price of agricultural products, which is the economy, plunges to practically nothing, and they can't get by. And one of the factors for the rise of fascism in all of its guises, it's called fascism in Italy, it's called National Socialism in Germany, it's called, it's called Franquism in Spain. No, he's not really a fascist. Franco is a right-wing authoritarian. He's still a murderer, but he's a right-wing authoritarian. But he's still a murderer, period. Is the economic situation. And I'll make this clear when I talk about Germany, because that's what drives the middle class, which is the first class to embrace Hitler. It's the big crisis of the great inflation in the early 1920s. And what helps drive peasants in all of these countries, the ones who become politicized and finally say, well, you know, what did the parliamentary regime bring me, my family? Not much. We just still can't get by. These little dictator guys thundering away, they seem to be telling it like it is. It's the Jews, or it's the Bulgarians, or it's the Romanians, or it's Hungarians, or it's the Serbs, or it's the Muslims, it's the Greeks, it's the Turks. I mean, you name it. You know, you fill in the national group. And it's a Europe of hatred. And it's a Europe of fear. An absorbed, integrated fear. I suppose that's kind of a silly way of putting it, but not that bad after all. And when they look around, what do they see? The first, you know, these countries are, you know, they're frightened. These powers, the new states, they ally. They say, well, we're going to have to lie together, and you know, some of them join up with France, and that won't do them much good in 1939. But there is this model that seems to be working in Germany. And the French, what they do in this inflation in the 1920s and 30s, you know, they were loaning money everywhere. You know, before they, you know, they pull in the reins, they bring in the credit. And Nazi Germany, particularly after, it is Nazi Germany, after January 1933, they provide this sort of model, and they say, well, look, you know, we'll help you out. We'll help you out. We'll the other countries are not buying your products. We'll buy even more of them. And we'll loan you money, and we'll organize this. And it seems to be an orderly society, and more about that. It's not just a society of coercion. Without jumping ahead, you know, Hitler seems to be providing things to the German people that they want. Work, I mean, the armaments factories, he's preparing for war. Order, you know, they're arresting petty criminals. I'll talk more about that. And racial purity. And they begin thinking, hey, that's a good thing. It's the fault of the Jews. And the Poles, it's the fault of the Poles. And, you know, when they invade Poland, this I don't emphasize this as much as I should have in your book, but you know, they begin right away carrying out genocide. They begin killing the Polish intelligentsia right away, and they kill the Polish generals right away. And the Russians are doing the same thing, actually, the Soviets further on. And so this is a permanent source of instability, this agrarian depression, this economic depression. But what it does, it's a factor for further destabilization. And talk about parliamentary regimes comes pretty cheap, but they disappear one after another. And in each and every case, in the fascists and variants, in each and every case, the discourse is we, the real people of this place. We do not want these other people here. We don't want them here. And of course, not all of these people carried it to the outcome of the Nazis or of the Lithuanians and the Ukrainians who just started beating Jews to death, you know, along the way. But it wasn't just the Western states that had great instability. And the willingness, indeed the eagerness, of people like Horthy to collaborate with Hitler openly, enthusiastically, all the way through until the bitter end, you know, is in part a result of that these right-wing movements become mass movements in these places, and as they did in Germany, and as they did you know, 8% of the population of the Netherlands votes for their guy called Musser, who's their little fascist guy, or in Belgium, you know, which is a town of shopkeepers, they support their guy who just died about 10 years ago, Lagrelle, De Lagrelle, I can't remember what his name is, who died on the Costa Brava. They all seem to die on the Costa Brava. They all basically get away with it and end up going to Spain, and a lot of them protected by the Franco regime, and they all seem to croak on the Costa Brava. But anyway, well, I got away from the text, but it doesn't matter. I didn't. I think I made my points anyway. And the points are that Europe is in a period of instability, that with the exception of the big powers in the West between 1924 and 1929, all these places are in depression, and that the sweeping away of parliamentary regimes in places that had virtually no parliamentary traditions at all was not all that surprising, and that it was compounded by the outcome of World War I. That again, as I've said before, at least twice, that the demons of the 20th century, you know, emerged from the war. And nowhere more tellingly and more appallingly, with greater costs, with greater devastation, with humanity sinking to an all-time low than that in Nazi Germany. And that's what I'm going to talk about next Wednesday. Monday, another cheerful topic, Stalinism, and we will go from there. Have a wonderful weekend, and I'll see you.